think Bob Pyle is teaching us how to keep the lamp lit, keep passing it on, and be good nurse logs. And the movie I mentioned earlier, Dark Divide, got a Seattle connection also, REI Productions, a good Seattle company. It's a wonderful film if you haven't seen it, and quite funny.
I'm played by David Cross. Yeah, it's a rather different Bob Pyle, but I love it. Yes.
Really funny, though. The Dark Divide.
DarkDividefilm.com. Tia, my dear Tia, was played by Deborah Messing, and she's spectacular. And of course, they're both great lefties.
Okay, our second speaker, you've already been introduced to earlier after that very beautiful panel that she was on yesterday, Sherin Hashimoto. Her first book, The Crane Wife, was reprinted by Red Hen Press in 2021. Her second poetry collection, More American, won the 2021 Off the Grid Poetry Prize and the 2022 Washington State Book Award in Poetry. You have seen for sale also her new collection, short story collection, her debut collection, Stealing Home, with Grid Books. Sherin Hashimoto, what a pleasure it is to have you among us.
Honor to have to like part through the crowd to get to the podium to read to all of you. Can you hear me well enough in the back, or do I have to kind of, okay, yeah, well, let me know if I'm dropping my voice or anything like that. Yes, there is. It wasn't that long ago that my husband, Michael Spence, who is a poet, and we like to call ourselves the Tukwila Couplet, and what we were doing is we were having the regular shopping day, and we were at PCC in Burien. And I think we were just rounding the aisle toward the dairy scene where you have your yogurt, your eggs, your butter, your milk. And this familiar hat shows up in front of us, and we start chatting with Paul. And he starts telling me about our festival and invites me. So I'm going to say, thank you. What a lovely way to be invited to this festival. So yesterday at the Issei Zen panel, I talked about my grandmother, and I read the poem, Seven Haiku for My Grandmother in the Kawabe House. And that's in the Cascadian Zen book. So I'd like to start off by reading the other poem that's in the book, which is about Nagasaki, and it's an abecedarian. So this is August 9th. After the flash blasting flat, the shoji screens, brushstroke cranes straining necks disappeared into ash. Mothers evaporated. Children floated on sides of buildings, ghosts of minutes before. Haloed light lingered, illuminating the cleared miles between blue jutting mountains and the horizon. Before the lover's kiss was complete, lips barely brushed, one mushroom cloud bloomed. Negative and positive burns outlined women's backs, patterns of water lilies or chrysanthemums, quotes inked on a scroll. Cries ricocheted throughout the ruins. Survivors stood, stuttering. So much was taken. Children sat hunched under broken umbrellas, rocking themselves. Vertical studs and walls creaked. Where would fireflies go? X-rays couldn't find them. Yanking on a barren branch, people discovered zero blossoms left to fall. I know a lot of you have been to many poetry workshops, and I think there was a reference to Kim Stafford.
Yes.
Okay. So some time ago, I too was at a workshop, and Kim was the moderator, organizer, everything else like that. And what he was trying to do is teach everybody that poetry is pretty much in anything, and that you could just pick things up, and that could become the source of a poem. And he was carrying around this toolbox, you know, wooden toolbox with a handle and everything on it. And he starts pulling things out of it. You know, he has like a maple leaf. You know, he found a shell from the beach. Other things he starts drawing out. He says, this could be a poem. This could be a poem. And what he does is finally is he picks out this piece, and it's a twisted wire. And he said, oh yes, I was wandering around, I think it was in Wyoming. And this was part of the what used to be Heart Mountain concentration camp. And it's a piece of barbed wire. So that gave me this poem, which where the first line is, the title is the first line of the poem. So this is, because you showed me a piece of barbed wire that had lain in the dirt road beside a lone sign marking all that remained of barracks, road and eclipse by the shadow of Heart Mountain. I thought of my mother beginning her tour of Japan. What would she say if she saw me with a piece of her past cupped in my hand? Would she tell me if the guard tower rose to her left, perhaps to her right, as she stepped down from the bus, sleepy and holding her mother's hand? Or would something simply remain unspoken? On the plane, she would be napping, the pages of a sunset magazine fanned by her breath. The small shutters close, the movie would flash by unremembered. But outside, clouds would buoy up the wings, buffet the metal. A suitcase in each hand, she'll wait patiently while my father scowls, passing through customs under neon signs she won't understand. Into Tokyo, they'll continue. I turn the knotted path of wire, smelling of ghost dust, touching the barbs that held everything in. I was a teacher at Highline Community College for about 29 years, and I taught a lot of freshman composition. I really loved students because their mistakes were my mistakes. And so pretty much I think I'm a lousy teacher, but I thought that I learned an awful lot from my students. And so I'm going to read a poem about being a student when I was very young. And in the classroom that I had, there was me, Japanese American, one other Japanese American girl, and then this new student who was Filipino. So this is called To Erlinda, 50 Years Later. Fourth grade, fifth grade, the principal didn't know where to place your IQ, but backed against the wall in a spelling bee, you went through oxymoron without pauses, knowing the rules. Say the word twice, before and after, or you're out. Take care of Erlinda, Miss Redlinger said to me, but you had no coat, no lunch, no 3 cents for milk, only the thin blue sweater and one dress you wore every day. I never knew you were hungry. Who kept you scrubbed, smelling of Clorox, your hair unevenly trimmed? In a nasal voice, you mimicked your aunt who put a mop in your muscles to work. Not that way. Then you'd frown and mutter, little bitch, words I didn't understand. When straight A Julie shot her hand up, you glared at her curled hair held back by berets. We were the other two Asians, Japanese, Filipino, dark-skinned and silent. You pushed your sweater sleeves up past your elbows or fastened the chip button bottom to top. For a week, we shared of mice and men, you tapping your pencil, waiting for me to flip the page so you could speed on to Lenny and his mouse. Your forehead furrowed. I didn't know you could glance at a paragraph and know Lenny would die. Because you were tardy then sick, I stopped saving assignments for you and counting the days you were gone. Absent from the photographs of our 8-page yearbook, you were only there in the beginning. Okay, and we just had such a lovely venue in the Richard Hugel House. And one of my teachers when I was in the master's program was David Wagoner. Okay. So after, you know, many years go by, Mike and I think it's going to be a really nice thing. He's teaching some literature classes about best American poetry. So we thought that we would take his class for about 8 weeks and learn about what he had to say about being editor for the Best American Poetry series. So this is called, so the person I'm talking about in here is David Wagoner. And this is called At the Richard Hugel House, February 2012. Cold on a Sunday in the creaky room, we shift in our chairs, lining the three sides of a table. An age spot rides a cheekbone. His whiskered eyebrows shudder as he follows an index finger, words rushed and stumbling, sometimes misread. Outside, a car alarm blares, the sound of switching on and off. Iambic, the bags of his jowl sigh. When the sunlight strikes the back of the old poet's head, he recites from a younger memory. Margaret, who is grieving for goldenrod unleaving. His voice grows deep as rivers, our faces reflected in the lens of the bifocals hanging on the edge of his nose. So yesterday I had the pleasure of meeting Barbara Johns for the first time, and she was part of our panel for the Issei Zen. And when I had my, I'm really proud of having a collection of short stories published. I mean, all my life I've been known as a poet, but people don't know that all that time I've also been writing short stories. So I had a manuscript and I had my press finally publish it, and we were talking so much about covers. And Barbara knows all this lovely stuff about these artists, the Issei artists who are in the Seattle area. And I didn't know her before, but through another friend, I got in contact with her, and she helped me with the cover of my book. So this is an abstract art. I'm not sure if you could see it, but this is still on display. She's curated a show with two other Issei artists, and this is from Kenjiro Nomura. Okay, I was so happy to get this cover. All right, and also to put it into the book. And because I'm so proud of my fiction writing as well as my poetry, I'm going to close by ending by reading a very short excerpt from one of my short stories. So I'm only going to read about three paragraphs, but this is from a short story called Vindaloo. Vindaloo. Hank Teraoka looked around the Indian restaurant filled with the smells of curry. He felt uncomfortable in the dark room, sitting next to the curtained window and fingering the one-page plastic menu. He couldn't help but catch glimpses of heavy brows, the cook's black eyes staring at him from the kitchen, a Japanese man in his 80s. Hank didn't understand anything on the menu, not the luncheon special. Shahi korma? But it was cheap, a plate lunch for only $7.95, with something called basmati rice, which to his mind should be Calrose or Nico Sticky White Rice. He had asked for the corner table where the light was brightest, where he and Tedu had sat only 9 months ago. Even then, he felt the two of them had been out of place. His wife's Seattle Mariners sweatshirt zipped up tight against the cold. They had stopped at this restaurant because they had always passed it on their way home from her kidney dialysis session. The background music with its lazy beat and quiverly stringed instrument hadn't mattered then. Hank laid down the menu against the bright orange tablecloth, picked up the water goblet, and took a sip. He half expected to see his wife's short white hair, the weight of her head tipping her chin down and making her look sleepy. Everything without Tedu was a first time. Aww. Thank you.
May I see that book cover?
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sharon. I think you make us all better people. Now look on the audience here too. I know so many of you, and I think of all that you've done, all the hard work that you do, given all the hard right work that needs to be done. So just thank you all. Thank you for being here, and thank you for being who you are. And our third speaker, Matt Treese, no stranger to you, even when he introduces people, there are poems in themselves, a little exercise in his collage technique. Artist, poet, IT analyst, but also very importantly, astrologer. Somebody won the astrology prediction, I think was that Yusuf-san, yeah. He was also a former member of the Cascadia Poetics Lab board, co-curates the Margin Shift reading series, and his poems have appeared widely in local and national publications. He is the author of the chapbook Later Heaven, Production Cycles in 2013. Really a singular voice and a very deep heart, Matt Treese.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks to Bob and Sharon. Those were really wonderful readings. I want to thank all of you for coming out for this wonderful weekend. It's just a joy to be a part of this organization and to be a part of this work. And I know our energies are conflicted at the moment. You know, Robert Duncan once said at the beginning of his collection, Bending the Bow, that we come again and again to the end of our history. And, you know, we cycle through this often, just like the end of Bob's poem, you know, things break down, but then things grow. And so I'm just going to read one part of one poem. I read a little bit of it last night. But it's a long poem where I'm trying to use divination techniques to listen to the Duwamish River. I had a kayaking trip where we were looking at the Duwamish Gardens project, and at one point we went over the remnants of the Northwind Weir. And, you know, it's part of the Duwamish creation myth of the world, which involves, like, not separating ourselves from all of nature. And so I'm going to read probably, this is about a 10-minute portion here, but it's trying to lean in not just to the doom and gloom of the apocalypse and the crises that we have, but to reach through to find the potency. Let me begin again. You've got a dark energy, a car on the corner waiting for something. I can't unsee. Your axe is not a song on the radio. I throw myself to ruins. The perfect things don't ease up. I was taught a means of taking power, but there is another reason for the wind shaking off my leaves stigma. natural when things lose their teeth and your tongue blood red, telling other people something I've learned to ignore, a dense detritus world that siren rings out flat all over town, floated at eye level like seabirds, clamshells, a white noise. I'm getting rid of some pendulum habits. I feel counteracted by education. I found most have been misled, losing touch with river bottom coursing through me. A hopeless prayer was never a deeper well. A tribe recognized in itself can birth the river. Such wetness gains liquid body rolled out of bed, cups of spring. I don't work that gravity in its simplicity of overt action, complexity we can roll around in, unknown processes catching tiny crumbs in the heart you thought was a small bird, a roach, a flower, even disarray needed practice puts us on a path, made thy music so other things I make easier every time, every emotion may grow, more rooms than I had fortunes for, time, ancient history, your lucky charm, resurgence in the face of genocide and extermination, where ordinary stories stand arm in arm with ordinary becoming involved in each other's lives, to take care of a deeper searching kind of introduction, to open this old lifeless town mud, remove the future panting like a man forespent. Panicked, we might depart from evil so extreme we have to ask permission to care for the ancestral government is unable to contain. Life laid away in the cemetery of the chimerical, the Duwamish bursts into the heart of the source, the dark elements. Do you know where your water comes from? This truth makes time appear to extend beyond now, to perform the perfection, the hideous sound, certain you don't have to hide. Sometimes good people draw troublesome things. Look imaginatively, give Soto back to the tides, the old ways, the fabric, then me thought a place beneath the skies, over Boeing Field had been eerily silent, a one-dimensional series of extensionless instants of time, colonized what hasn't even yet born its human nature, that point to which from every part is dragged, these body things must be put to work. It keeps you running, never seems to relax. I would have to take time feeling things, waiting for the end. The source operates as though the wind takes your trouble. I move awkwardly over a wide field, the country reliving a sip of something I can barely taste, the same feeling. You never feel its wild note. You're really not thinking with pigeons, not knowing these string figures, trying to make it far enough. It'll follow me home, making a truer sound, gesture transporting logs between the freshwater lakes. I'm seeing to the east the saltwater inlets. Didn't want to be disturbed. Didn't want the creek realm of the gods, that confusion trail spent with fear, a car, the corner provides, the framework. You don't ease up on the occupation in this solidness of place. One is less conscious of crossing that threshold. I can't hear not enough living on the outside. This parasite, its favorite reading, feeding ground, I never seem to get to the next little seersucker, time rootlets into the cracks in the floor listening, to every excuse an ambivalent muse will hear below the softest seepage I'm keeping alive. The Duwamish tribe has an indisputable right to not see the canal as improvement. Winds contriving that old game, that ventriloquizing authenticity of place that speaks in between lines. I am defenseless against the sales pitch, not real in a land of abstraction smoke, escapes when all the windows are down, produces the inhibition you never feel, settled down in the tall grass, waiting for life we can roll around in. The disarray you hold close calls you by name, what you thought crushed beneath seas. We return to these rhythms the body forms. I got all faced up, inanimate, jealous divinity demanding sounds like 1963, but for now sounds like the root of a tree twisted up at the tail. I never thought we'd go this long, braiding willow branches into a crown clarity of space. The stars heal the broken parts I carry, uttermost inch the river I still want to see in blossoms at dawn. I wanted so much for magic to be real thought. The whole world was ending cloud huddled mountain god. I say a little prayer to drive away ideal conditions, work upon this nature I carry, the end desired place of many fishes, of butterflies I always keep leaning on, the windowsill you could write me, broken parts, jade green. I say a little prayer for the Tecumseh Republic, every second brimming of majesty, thinking this bicycle of the earth mind animals were snorting and rearing as if they wished to break through the house hell in paradise. I always try to keep with me Godkins I never heard all my life, displayed with great pride that maketh the leaf talk to me and the flower ancient cultural artifacts, the moon and sun, keepers of the weather, come out when I hear the clamor clouds are all rolling by the birds, their song. I don't know what I'd do without keeping me material. They left me in the Duwamish River, wild blackberries and apple trees, broken parts I carry without measure. My body is to the greatest extent what everything is, a dimensional this I feel, a little more the universal thing I want to bathe in. Dreams are not your dreams, they're only we pause for station identification, for sorrows and misery whose movements seem practiced. The person you thought you'd put a hex passed from person to person. No history, but that haunting got to keep moving lament. There is no place for hatred in the relativistic matter. Tuned in harmony time, many tell the bartender you've had enough change in the weather notes. Not apprehended this world dangerous to his story in that the trains are on time. But we're lost at the station, still lost in I will begin to dissolve visions of symbiosis, swallowing us, simply living together in physical contact. I feel so all organisms are touching, bathed in the same still blue silence, sleepwalking, the same flowing damage in my eyeglass of sweet vermouth. Lays me down when I'm fading these gaseous demons that hover above our wretched resurrection song intensities. Do you think God gets a bang out of the street, has no end of ellipses? The elaboration, I left these fields a war correspondent, rooting up this beautiful verdant meadow quest of a species of wild wandering preeminence, I won't stop singing resurrection, beating a wry thumb on this canoe, dreaming this world is no shortage, trees shiver and sway. You ever seen wild boars and stags and hares, the surrounding splendor of you and yours, a goodwill that a good mind keeps steady energy on or near the lake fork of the Duwamish River. I'll touch the fruit itself, the clear prepotency I still love. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Matt. That was awesome. You know, just listening to these three remarkable speakers, the phrase that keeps popping in my head is the phrase that we got from Yeats, that Achebe makes a big deal of, things fall apart. I think about how we live all over the world. What do we think is going to happen? It's going to end well. Of course, it's going to be very, very bad. Exhibit A, Tuesday. No matter what happens in the election, I hope we survive. But it's really the symptom of a much deeper problem that won't go away on Tuesday. That's all true. But then I think of these beautiful poets as we are near this nurse log. Things fall apart, but the nurse log, things break down. And as Bob told us, then things grow. And then things grow. That's a really, really important teaching. I think it was fully evident in the last 3 days. All of your works, how you live your lives. So thank you. Thank you. And Bob now will conclude the program with a benediction, and I will see you all at Subud House later.
Thank you, Jason. Oh, lovely brother. Thank you so much. And Sharon. What a deep honor to be reading with these two poets and everyone else, and it, for you all to listen to us. What a gift. Matt, I would not want to have to diagram that sentence. But I'm pretty damn sure it was completely grammatical all the way through, with not too many semicolons. And Sharon, how moving. How moving, dear. And I've known and followed you forever, and to get to share a music stand with you, however wonky. A great honor, and I can't wait to read your short stories. Quickly, I'm sorry, bit of administrivia. Is the person who won my book Mariposa Road last night in the raffle in the room? Will you talk to me afterwards, please? Thank you. And I wanted to say something about metaphor, and that is this tree here, this nurse log, what could be a more wonderful metaphor for all we do than a nurse log? But you know what? That ain't no damn metaphor right there. That's the real thing. And how I feel so much honored this entire time. But I have to tell you, I'm sorry, but an order of magnitude more to be here with Ms. Hemlock than all of us combined. And I just looked up and I saw one of my very favorite plants growing in the corner of the room with the pendant pedicels of dried flowers right up there against the sky. And that's goat's beard. And if you don't know it in springtime, drive up the Stevens Pass Road, Highway 2, on the west end of the High Line in June. And it'll be blooming all the way from about 1,500 feet to about 3,900 feet.
What about Stinky Bob?
Oh, well, there is Stinky Bob, yeah. Thank you, Paul, for reminding me. There's I don't like the word invasive for any plant. It has a political agenda, but there are plants that we prefer not be growing exactly where they are. Never demonize a so-called invasive weed. Oh, work against them where they're harming native plants you want to have there, for sure, but never demonize an organism. They're only doing what they were evolved to do, and they're there because we put them there. We fucking put them there, okay? But one of them is rampant on the, is that word okay? It grows adventitiously along the roadsides in the Olympics and elsewhere, and it's not welcomed by the Park Service, but it's called Herb Robert or Stinky Bob. And Paul very kindly asked earlier if it was named for me, and I said, you bet. I think that was it. Yes. So this is to take us out, I hope. And it was written for a Forests and Waters event in Astoria a few months ago that a number of activists have started a new group, and guess what? They're young, which was the most thrilling part. They're going back in one more time for a go for the Forests and the Waters. So this is called, and it will be in the new book that Jason San mentioned, which is called Swimming with Snakes, Encounters with the Actual World. Poems and prose, or prose bits as well as poems, and that will be coming out from Watershed, I'm so happy to say. With it covered by the same person who did the Rainbow Bear on the bear book. For the forests, horizontal and vertical. And this is for Roger Dorband, a great forest activist in Astoria, and all the other forest conservationists. So for all of you. Gazing over the river now at the hills of Willapaw, or from the other side toward Clatsop, what you mostly see is absence of what was there before. The trees, the giant trees, the many trees, the greatest green trees this lovely lonely land or any other has ever known. We needn't ask when they all went or why. We know these things, and we, or our forebears, were part of it with our appetites, desires, needs, and greed. But what comes next, and what will we leave? These we may ask. These we must, when gazing across the Columbia now. Yes, the old growth's long gone now. But when I came to Willapaw, these 45 years past, the second growth, the legacy forests, as we call them now, was well along, self-sown, unplanted, unsprayed, full of returning life, like encetina and torrent salamanders, wintergreen and bunchberry, queen's cup and wood sorrel, warblers and woodpeckers, crossbills and grouse, the owls. But then came the change-ups, the sellouts, unions out, profits up, mill jobs traded for log exports, rotations down from 75 years to 30. These woods were good for jobs and logs and habitat for 50 years and more, but they all went down in 15. Someone thought the profit worth the cost. But never mind. So now we face these skinned and bitter hills and ask, what's next? For every twig and tree we save will be tomorrow's hope and prayer.